I know, you really want to get back to that awesome podcast you were just listening to, but this awesome podcast has given me a quick time slot to pitch you my awesome podcast, Black Flare. We are a tabletop RPG actual play podcast using the Delta Green gaming system. It's like we're playing Dungeons & Dragons, but in place of fantasy, it's more akin to The X-Files or True Detective. If you like audio dramas, suspense, and a bit of horror, I think you should give Black Flare a listen. Thanks for sticking through my pitch. Happy listening.
Hey, Chris here. Before we get started with the show today, I want to let you know a couple things. First off, one of our guests, James Babbo from Middle Pillar Comics, you might remember him. He was our guest on the Cemetery Man episode, you know, the one that scarred Fergal forever. He's given us a pack of five of his comics, and he's asked us to give it to one of our listeners. Well, that's you. So that means it's time for another giveaway. If you go to our site, movie-smash.com, there's a page for giveaways. This is not just for our U.S. listeners. I don't care where you live. If you win, I'm going to mail these comics to you. This giveaway goes until June 30th, 2025. Lastly, since you're listening, thanks again for subscribing to the show. Without you, there wouldn't be one. We want to hear from you, so drop us a note, leave us a review, or let us know how we're doing. And now on to the show. It's strange that he's had two movies where he's killed his parents with a pillow in both of them.
What exactly is real?
Me personally, like, I don't need to see it anymore. You know what I mean? But then again...
And yes, I do own the steelbook for this movie.
All right. I want a number two.
I can see why people did not like this movie.
Hello, and welcome to Movie Smash!
Hello, and welcome to Movie Smash, the show where we dive headfirst into comic book movies outside of the MCU. If you're new to the show, thanks for joining us. If you've been here before, you know the drill. Each episode, we're going to smash a movie whose source material is from a graphic novel or a comic. Is it worth revisiting? Should it be forgotten? Let's find out. This is Movie Smash. I'm one of your hosts, Chris Roberts. I'm the founder of Off Panel Creations. With me today, I have the man who has too many burgundy suits in his closet, Jeremy Parmentier.
Hey, this is Jeremy Parmentier of Retrovaniacs, also a troubled individual in society, but I use it to create podcasts.
Our guest host this evening is returning to us for a second time, Joffrey Cotton.
Hey, what's up, everyone? I'm Joffrey. I'm the head of Kingdom Comics, and I'm just a comic book guy all around.
Well, thanks for joining us again. Obviously, you enjoyed yourself last time, or hopefully you did, because that's why you showed up again.
I did. I had fun, man.
Our movie tonight is 2019's Joker, starring Joaquin Phoenix, Robert De Niro, and Zazie Beetz, directed by Todd Phillips.
When I was a little boy and told people I was going to be a comedian, everyone laughed at me. Well, no one's laughing now.
You can say that again, pal.
For my whole life, I didn't know if I even really existed. But I do. And people are starting to notice.
You think this is funny? Is this a joke to you?
So, Joffrey, you picked this movie. I think last time you picked Blade, but this time we're going over to over DC. Why'd you pick this movie?
I've been a fan of Joaquin Phoenix for a long time, and then I watched a documentary about him on Netflix where he was kind of not doing that great. And this was, you know, just kind of pay homage to him, I guess, in a way. This is a really good return to his, you know, he's got a good way of taking over these movies that he does. And he's one of the few characters that I like in Gladiator that when I was really first exposed to him, on that kind of scale, that made you like actually hate him, you know, like as a character, but he did a great job, you know, not like Joffrey, ironically, in Game of Thrones, where people were like booing him out of the career, but, his performance in that movie was excellent. And I thought the same thing about the Joker. It was just a very dark movie, you know, from like a human being side. It's like not the most pleasurable thing to watch at times, but it was just so well done.
I'm glad you mentioned The Gladiator, though. It's strange that he's had two movies where he's killed his parents with a pillow in both of them.
That's a good point.
So I assume you guys were familiar with the Joker as a character before seeing this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to say you're into comics at all without being familiar with the Joker. So
was this your first time seeing this movie?
Not for me. I've seen it several times. I think two or three times. But the refresher was nice. It's been a while, so I wanted to make sure I had some talking points. And I even went so far as to watch the majority of the second one as well. And if we want, we can get into that later or whenever.
Yeah, I had seen this not when it first came out, because it kind of had this. I mean, it was. I didn't think there was a need for a Joker movie when I first heard about it, and then It was kind of like, well, no, it's like an offshoot. It's like an alternate world Joker. So I was a little more interested, but I didn't see it in the theaters because it was 2019. It's not a kid's movie at all, as we're going to find out. So I didn't go to the movies. I don't go to the movies very often anyway, especially without my kids. So I didn't get to see it in the theaters. When I did finally see it the first time, it was after, I don't remember where I was. I was out with some friends or at band practice or something. I came home and I had a couple beers first. So I came home and my wife was watching it, and I came in after the last hour. Completely different situation when you don't see the first half of this movie and you only see the second half. So I was like, I need to see this again. So I did watch it again a while later and was like, I do like this a lot more than when I just watched the back half. And then I watched it again today for a clear take again on it as like a third viewing. So I have seen it before, but this might be the second time I could say I saw it for real.
Yeah, I only saw this movie once before. I think it came out in October, because I believe I saw it one of the first weeks of December the year it came out. And because it had come out, I wanted to go see it, but never had the chance. And a buddy of mine said, you know, just bought tickets randomly, said, we're going to go see the movie this weekend. And of course, it was the only place it was playing, and it was in this rundown college theater by where I live. So it looks like it had not been a place that had not been updated since the 80s. So it was very fitting for the time frame of this movie.
Nice.
So, Jeremy, do you have any little comic book history on who the Joker actually is?
I mean, again, you can't say you're into comics at all if you don't know the Joker. I mean, he was introduced in Batman number one, which is not the first Batman comic, but actually the first comic named after Batman. And he's been the Batman's foil ever since. He's an evil clown is the easiest way to describe him, but he has different versions of himself across the years. And, you know, as we're going to, you know, you've seen him in the 1989 Batman with Jack Nicholson's version. You saw him in 1966. We covered on this podcast, you have Cesar Romero's version of the Joker, which is kind of like the classic campy Joker. And then, of course, you have Heath Ledger's Joker, which at the time I thought was mind-blowing. So I was like, how could you beat these versions of the Joker? And there's also the cartoon Joker that Mark Hamill voices. There's lots of different variants. But the fact that this is a different take on the Joker, as we're going to find out, Joaquin Phoenix, I think, did a pretty interesting take on the Joker.
Yeah, and I would agree. I'm still one of those people that is on the Heath Ledger bandwagon. Like, he just, I mean, it's kind of hard to top that. And then everything that happened consequently and all that after that with his life and everything. But yeah, his performance, and then Bale and Christopher Nolan, all that was kind of like the perfect storm. So I figured that was going to be hard to top. And then I know a lot of people don't like Jared Leto's version of him. I'm kind of mixed on that. You know, I like the campy kind of stylized kind of look, and I'm actually, I don't know if I'm one of the few, but I'm a Jared Leto fan. So I thought he did a pretty good job, but Joaquin Phoenix came in and kind of stole the screen again. And I thought he just did a really good job on a very different approach to the Joker character.
I was doing a little reading before coming to this, and I actually found out that this movie is what killed the Jared Leto Joker. They were going to do their own Jared Leto Joker movie, but this did so well that they decided never to pursue that Joker again. But we'll get more into that a little bit later. And yes, I do own the steelbook for this movie. So, quick spoiler warning, if this is your first time joining us, just a heads up. And we're going to be discussing some elements of this very dark reboot of Patch Adams. It might be considered spoilers, so consider yourself warned. So, Joffrey, can you walk us through the plot of this movie?
Sure. So, you know, it's about a regular guy, fledgling entertainer, if you will. And I'm just kind of on the fringe of society. Lives with his mom. He's got issues there. And it just really tracks his slow descent into madness, if you will. Or some people would kind of call it a rebirth of sorts. I thought Todd Phillips did a very good job of kind of towing that line where, I don't know how to explain it really, but like where you can't... Is it a moment where you want to root for the guy, or is it a moment where you kind of want to be like, ugh, this guy's bad news, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, the main character, the Joker, obviously, titular character, they did a lot of work to really try to humanize him at parts, if you saw the first half of the movie. Well, now, if you only saw the last half of the movie, like Jeremy, you probably didn't feel that for that type of viewing. But why don't we jump into the characters? We'll come back to the Joker in a second, but were there any other characters that really stood out to you besides the Joker?
Yeah, the whole cast was really good. Robert De Niro, obviously, he's good in everything he does, and... the mother, though, she was great. That's kind of what I felt like the story centered around, was his issues with her. And you see that all kind of come to a head later on in the movie. And then I thought an interesting addition by Phillips was to do the young Bruce Wayne and Alfred in that scene where they're at the gate. I always kind of thought it was kind of creepy and weird, but it makes a lot of sense when you go back and watch it, because again, it's a very different take with this Arthur Fleck character So it creates, there's a, you know, spoiler, you know, spoiler alert, but he believes that he's Bruce Wayne or Thomas Wayne believes that he's his son. So I guess he would be Bruce's half brother or something like that. Right. So and so he has to come to that realization that he's not. And it's like a really big moment for him in his life. And he kind of has this existential crisis. And it's kind of what blows the door wide open, if I do remember right. And, but yeah, it was interesting to see them. I felt like there was times when I felt like they could have just left that alone. Because there was really, at times I kind of like, well, that was, you know, there's no point in adding Batman or any kind of iteration of him in this movie. But being a little more, being a little older now and having seen it, more times, than the original time I saw it, I do understand and appreciate that a lot more now.
Yeah. I would also say, to back up on that, his mother, Penny Fleck, is integral to understanding where Arthur is in life and why he feels that Bruce or that Thomas Wayne is his father. And, you know, that he feels like he's been left behind, right? He's Thomas Wayne's forgotten son. He is, you know, he desperately needs help. His mother is sick, in and out of the hospital. She's clearly not mentally all there. Sometimes you're not quite sure what's going on there. And knowing as the story unravels her background with everything really explains a lot more about Arthur. So it's the movie's not just about Arthur Fleck becoming the Joker. I mean, it is, but a lot of that, you know, storyline also goes through his mother's storyline, which we get pieces of in flashbacks, which I really did like.
Yeah, like if we believe the medical records about Penny, she is the reason Arthur is the way he is.
Yes.
But 100%. The one thing I want to touch on as we talk through this is that we do have an unreliable narrator. This is a story from the Joker's perspective. I mean, he's telling this to that therapist at the end of the movie. So the question is, how much of this is real and how much of this is just, you know, him making up as he goes along? I've always wondered, like, seeing this the second time, you start watching, like, okay, I can see where he might be changing things as he tells a story.
Oh, certainly. And Joker in general is always kind of an unreliable narrator. That's why I like every version of the Joker, every movie version, every story version has a slightly different background. It's sometimes it's completely out there like this. Other times it's a variant on the, you know, fell into a vat of chemicals kind of standard comic storyline, but they still alter that enough. So you're never really sure what the Joker's background is. And I think the Heath Ledger Joker kind of nails that because he has three different backgrounds he tells people movie. And this does the same thing where you're not quite sure because this is this whole thing just Arthur talking to his therapist at the, you know, in prison at the end. Is that been the whole story? Is just him making this all up? But some of it can't all be made up, or, you know, otherwise he wouldn't be in this facility. There are definitely things that happen that the sequel makes it very clear what's true and what's not, which is a positive and a negative, I think, because I did, watching it on as a standalone, Chris, I had the exact same thoughts as how much of this is real. Because even the stuff that you think is real that you realize isn't in the movie, for example, his neighbor, who's played by Zazie Beetz, whose name I don't remember, he thinks he has like this kind of weird, it's not even like a lot of relationship scenes, but after they meet one time, there's like, they go out one time, and then it's like, she's in the hospital with him when he's visiting his mother and all this other stuff, but then even he realizes like, this was never real, kind of later on in the movie. So then you're like, how much of this is completely unreal? Was even the stuff in the city real? Did he even kill those three people in the subway, which is kind of what starts the unraveling of Gotham further, you know, more directly as a riot, right? So there's all these things you're like, what exactly is real? And for better or worse, the sequel does paint that at the very beginning. Like, here's exactly what happened. Because that's not coming from him. It's coming from the story.
Before I forget, one thing, going back to the unknown history of the Joker, in the medical records actually says that he was adopted from unknown parents. They didn't know who his history was, even in the medical records.
Right. And even before, it was, you know, even on the times where they've given his story, it's more of how he became the Joker, not where he was born or who his parents were or anything like that. It was always how did he become the Joker. In this case, you don't need any of that. You know his mom, sort of. You know his adopted mom, you find out. But, like, it still has more into the why is he having this sort of breakdown that would lead to him becoming the Joker, if it's real or not.
Yeah, in that relationship we talked about with his neighbor, what was her name again? It was...
The neighbor's name is Sophie Dumond.
And so, obviously, about halfway through the movie, we learned that his entire... I don't want to use the word relationship, but their connection was fake. In the original writing of the script, it was actually... She took pity on him and actually did go on those dates with him, or at least go on a date with him, though he saw it as much more than that. Come to find out she has a boyfriend, which is what pushes him over the edge. I enjoyed this version to that original writing of it, but... It was not supposed to be sort of like a, it wasn't real situation.
Yeah, one of those kind of dissociative identity disorders or something that's, you know, you see that in a lot of movies like Memento and there's a couple of Vacancy and there's other ones as well, you know. Bug is another one that's really good with that. And I like it, though. It keeps you guessing and wondering at the end of it all. It's like, well, I mean, what really, what's going on here? And it's cool because it leaves it open to interpretation. And like y'all said, as far as the different origins and stuff, like how Heath Ledger nailed it about, you know, you want to know how I got these scars? And the Batman, the comic book, The Three Jokers was really good that Fabik did. I forget who else was there with him. But anyways, that was really neat because you get to see, like, there's these different versions of him. And I forget a lot about how the context of that story, but again, you know what I mean, as far as how that ties into his origins and just the different iterations and all that different stuff about him, you know?
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you brought up The Three Jokers. And I've not read that book. I have it on my shelf. But I think it goes along the lines that there are actually three different Jokers.
Correct. It explains that the Joker has been different iterations of Joker throughout the year, not the same person, but different people portraying him. And in some cases, they work together. And there's at least three, right? There's the three that are the focus of that.
Right, right. There could be more.
What did you guys think of the Joker's laugh?
Oh, that's what I was going to say and mention earlier. That was one of the big things that sealed it for me as far as Joaquin's performance and as far as this version of the Joker, how they use that as a medical condition that I had no idea existed. I'm assuming it does. And that it wasn't just made up for the movie. And the way he did it, and then combine that with his gaunt appearance and the aesthetic of all that. And I wouldn't say creepy, but it was like, and not really disturbing, because you know me, I do horror comic books, but pretty unsettling and like really like polarizing. Like whenever he's doing those laugh moments, and it seems to happen at the worst times, of course, right? You know, people want to beat him up because they think he's making fun of them, or people pull their children away because they think he's creepy. And he's just a poor guy with a condition, you know what I mean? And I'm sure there's some symbolism and stuff and some parallels in there somewhere, but I thought that part was just great.
Yeah, the condition was called PBA. I looked this up, a pseudo-pulbar effect, which is a real condition that you laugh at uncomfortable situations.
I mean, yeah, even in this movie, like there's the scene where he's going to check on his mom in the hospital. He's stopped by the police outside and they kind of mention like, oh, this car, this, you know, medical condition, is this even real? And he responds, like, he looks right at him. He's like, what do you think? And then he walks in. So there's kind of this, yes, you think it's real, but at the same time, is it? He's very unreliable as a narrator, as we kind of discussed. But even with all that said, you kind of feel for him because even as he's having these breakdowns, like when he's on the subway and he's getting attacked by those three guys, you understand why he would retaliate. Now he goes too far, obviously, and he clearly probably shouldn't have killed them, right? I mean, that's not the right way to go about it. And the third guy, he clearly hunts down and kills. So that's aside from just defending yourself. But every time one of these things happen, you understand why it happens. You saw him get attacked earlier in the movie, so you could see why he's getting attacked again now, and he's already lost his job. He's had the worst day of his life. You know, it really makes you feel for this guy, even though, you know, ultimately, you know, in the back of your head, he's going to be the Joker.
But yeah, basically, there's a lot of characters in this movie, but there aren't really, this movie is a character piece on the Joker as it is. But I like the supporting cast, like I can't name most of the other people in this movie. Like there's the detectives. They might have names. I don't know what they are. But I think it's really, Jeremy, I think you touched on it, it's really just Penny Fleck, Arthur Fleck, and then the Waynes.
Also, I think Murray Franklin is a very important character in this movie. Not only is he obviously involved in the
De Niro,
end,
for sure.
He's,
yeah.
Oh, De Niro,
know,
sorry.
There the whole time as, you know, Arthur has these dreams and daydreams where he's going to be on the show. Also, just as a side note, I thought having, Jesus Christ, what's the actor that was, I know, I'm drawing a blank on a major actor. Oh, De Niro. Okay, I got it, De Niro. No, Robert De Niro. Sorry. Okay. You'll have to edit this in since I'm such a mushmouth. Also, a side note, I think having Robert De Niro play Murray is a great pick because he was Rupert Pupkin in a movie called The King of Comedy, which is, this movie is hitting all the same beats of. It's very similar. It's not as dark as this by any means. It is a comedy where, a darker comedy, but an earlier dark comedy than a violent comedy, where he has these, you know, delusions that he's going to be famous and he basically, you know, kidnaps his way onto The Tonight Show. And it's the same kind of thing where you're not sure what's real or not. But anyway, so Arthur keeps, you know, he's living his life to try to get on this show because he's watched it since he was a kid. He watched it with his mom. And even in his delusions, the dream where he goes on the show earlier in the movie, Murray says, oh, you know, you're a great kid. If I had a son like you, I'd be so proud. Like, so he's not only fantasizing about being on the show because he wants to be famous. He's replaced, at least in part, his lack of a father with this television show that he's watched with his mom forever.
kind of like a father figure in a weird way, because him and his mother watch the show religiously, and he values him as a comedian and where in his level of his stature, his level of success in life, and really a spot really looks up to him, you know. And then he finds out that he's been recorded candid camera and that it's getting around the airwaves and stuff, and he wants him to come on the show, and I'm pretty sure he's oblivious to it at that point. Then he finally gets like the wake up call when he sees it on TV or when he gets to the show. I'm sorry, I can't remember. But nevertheless, again, he gets the rug pulled out from under him, and he's like just a huge blow to his everything. You know what I mean? It's like his world kind of comes crashing down. So you can see why it ended on such a violent, ugly tip at the end. But I think Murray, in a very subtle way, was also integral to that dynamic, that relationship between Arthur and Penny, just because he was center to all of that, you know, as far as the time they shared revolving around his show and stuff, you know?
Well, and you brought up a great point with him kind of being like a father figure. He's already been, I don't want to say abandoned, but officially, you know, informed the person he thinks is his father is not his father. And so then he's this other person who he's looked up to and has been very excited about, you know, someday maybe going to even see a show in person, not even be on the show. Has been openly mocking him for his stand-up, which I also don't think he realized that his stand-up had bombed at the time. Either he did it at the moment and then deluged himself out of it later, because he was still doing, like, writing jokes and doing stuff. And that's when he saw it on the TV that he was like, oh, wow, they're focusing on this. He's making fun of me. And I think it's also him kind of realizing, like, wait, this thing that in my mind was a really good stand-up appearance and, like, kind of coming out of my shell as a comedian was actually a disaster. And I had no idea, right? So it's more like about the walls of his delusions, and then forcing him to confront it as, you know, all these other things happen in the background that keep pushing him farther to where he would make the decisions he makes. But ultimately, he's invited on the show live, again, as a gag, and he does realize it's a gag to some level, but he decides, and he makes it very clear, his goal is to go on the show and kill himself in front of an audience, a live TV audience, because, you know, maybe his life will make more sense than his death, in spelled C, or is that his comic thing, or his journal. Like, he goes here for the full intent of he has nothing left to live for. Maybe he can make a giant scene in his death and become infamous or whatever by doing that. That's what his goal is at the moment before he actually gets on stage.
And that scene is very reminiscent of the scene in The Dark Knight Return. Dark Knight Returns? There's a book, essentially, Batman's much older at this point. He's retired. He's got to come back. It takes place like in the 80s, I think.
Oh, yeah. That's a great series.
And the Joker goes on a talk show and kills everybody. It's very reminiscent of that scene.
That stand-up scene that he does where he's trying to get his jokes out, and again with that laugh where he can't get it out, and it's just so hard to watch, man. It's really tough. And it's like, want to pull for the guy so bad. It's like, man, just put the shovel down, you know, but he can't help it, you know, and he's trying his hardest. And you're like, man, I really want rooting for this guy. But man, he just can't get out of his own way, it feels like, because of this condition, you know?
So also, I mean, up to this point, Arthur hasn't proved that he's funny at all. Like, you saw him be a clown, but it was, you know, he was doing like a mattress sale. It was more just like, could have been anything. It didn't have to be a clown. The only time you see him actually perform where he seems to be getting the response that would be rewarding for him is when he's in the children's hospital, right? He's in there. He's trying to entertain children with cancer. He's got them all doing the Happy and You Know It dance. They all seem to be into it. Again, there's a question, I guess, of whether or not this is real. But either way, he feels like he's getting the response he deserves. And of course, you know, he has this handgun in his outfit that drops out by accident. And he ends up getting fired over it as he sees it as a misunderstanding. Obviously, you don't bring a handgun to a children's hospital. But, you know, I also want to bring up this handgun. I know we're kind of all over the place, but, you know, this movie's all over the place. So this is fitting. But he gets this handgun. You see, he gets a handgun from one of the other clowns at the clown office. And he says, oh, I'll give this to you for after he got beat up. He's like, you need to have this. This happens more than you think or whatever. And he gives him a handgun. But then later in the movie, that same person reports the handgun as that he stole it from him. And, you know, then there's a question of none of the other clowns seem to like Arthur, right? The only clown that likes him is the little person clown. Everybody else seems to, like, make fun of him flat out or kind of be like that. You know, he's nice to him, sort of, but really they're just making fun of him on the side. Like, there's no one there that seems to like him. So are they setting him up with a gun? Or is it exactly as you saw, and for some reason he feels like he has to make sure he tells the police, oh, no, he stole this gun from me. You can't tell.
Well, I think it is hard to tell because the unreliable narrator, But he does come back to his apartment and says, I want to make sure we get our story straight. So I kind of think maybe the guy did set him up because his story wasn't straight at that point. And now he's coming back to make sure his story is straight with the guy, so he's not getting in trouble for giving a, I forgot how they described it. Basically, he used to be in a mental asylum himself, Fleck, and he's not allowed to carry a handgun because of his social worker. He might get in trouble for giving him that gun. So he's got to make sure his story is right that he bought it from him. Because I think he might have given him the gun to actually, because he's supposed to have a gun, protect himself. But once he got the police come, he's like, hey, I got to protect myself. So I'm going to get my story straight, which is you try buying it off me or from a supervisor, telling a supervisor, he tried buying it from me because I have nothing to do with that because I don't want to get in trouble. Because we all know the clown industry is cutthroat. You gotta stab somebody in the back every now and again.
You know, obviously with not current, but they can use ballistics to figure out what gun it came from. Knowing where the gun was originally owned or whatever is obviously going to be a cause for concern, even if he did honestly get this gun from this guy. So it made sense for him to come there, but then I wasn't sure, like, if he didn't get the gun from him, is he just labeling him out because he got him fired? So now he's like, oh, I'm going to get even with him? Because he says after, when he goes back to clean his locker, like, I still do owe you for that, don't I? So then I was not sure, you know, did he actually ever get the gun from him, or is he just saying that?
This movie is rated R. It was one of the few rated R movies for, it's a comic book movie. I think it's the first comic movie to hit $1 billion in earnings. So it did very well. But originally it was going to be an NC-17 movie until they cut a few certain scenes out. And hearing that, my first thought is, before seeing this movie, I was like, this thing was rated R, you know, comic movie, almost NC-17. This thing's got to be bloody. This thing's got to be gory. There's actually not too many deaths in this movie.
No, but they're realistic. Like the final scene at the talk show is pretty graphic for what it is, and it's very realistic. If you've seen any of the footage of anyone who shoots himself on camera, which you probably shouldn't want to hunt down, but if you are that kind of sicko like I may have been in the past, it looks accurate. Like it looks like you'd expect. But there's also just like the fighting on the subway, it's a pretty violent movie without being, it's not cartoonishly violent. It's just very realistically so.
I think the bloodiest, the most violent part, but it was still just merit an R rating to me, was when he goes back to that apartment and lets the short guy live, but just viciously murders the other guy with a knife or something. And he just goes nuts and he's just covered in blood. He like walks past that guy, like the little man's looking at him like, am I next? You know, and he's got his goal. You know what I mean? He had his mind made up what he wanted to do and he went and did it. But the way he was just so nonchalant about it at the end, like it just, turning off that switch and turning it back on that was intense. It's pretty good.
I think I read somewhere there's only 8 deaths in the whole movie.
That sounds about right. Because he killed, 5 people? 6, including his mom?
Let's see here. The 3 guys on the subway, Murray, his mother, that's 5. And the other clowns, so 6. And then the 2 Waynes.
He doesn't kill the 2 Waynes.
No, I say 8 med deaths for the whole movie.
Well, the other 2 cops, I mean, you don't necessarily see them die. And in fact, I think they say they're in intensive care. But that's you know, they are essentially, you know, probably more graphic than most of the deaths you actually, you know, do get to see. Even the Wayne deaths really aren't incredibly graphic. They're just Wayne deaths, which you'd expect in pretty much any bad.
How did you feel the fact that they made the crime alley scene happen in this movie?
Yeah, I had, I think that kind of connects with the gate scene where that more so than the gate scene, because we've seen that. I mean, as Batman fans and Joker fans, we've seen that moment play out in so many different medias and so many times, and the pearls dropping, and was the Joker the guy with the gun? Is Jack Napier the Joker? Yada, yada, yada. And it's just, it's one of those things where, me personally, like, I don't need to see it anymore. You know what I mean? But then again, they wanted to use, and that's kind of the part, I guess, where I was saying I had a problem with. They were eager to put in Bruce Wayne and to kind of connect and draw those connections there and maybe draw some parallels somehow. But like, they really wanted to put him in there and make him be a part of that story where it was a time I felt like they could have done without it. But the gate scene I did really enjoy because you get to that realization that he thinks he's Thomas Wayne's son. That really didn't have anything to do with the alley scene, if I remember right. That was just like them wanting to show a Batman origin story again. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And generally, there's such a small tie to the rest of what you'd expect in the DC universe. So, you know, yes, you're in Gotham, but other than having the Wayne death scene in there, there's not a ton of connection to even Batman, really. Now, again, I think you need to have some sort of connection. I know there was a question throughout the announcing and final finishing of the movie of how much of this will be canon or whatever. Ultimately, it was decided this is kind of its own separate world, its own separate telling of the Joker story and their own interpretation. But I don't mind that there's not a ton of DC Universe callbacks.
Well, originally, this movie was going to be a one and done. Joaquin Phoenix only signed up originally because he said, this is a one and done. I want to be part of any franchises. I don't want to do any sequels until they paid him $50 million or whatever the number was. But for the
well, he also said he wasn't going to come back unless it was something he really wanted to do. Even after a little bit, he said he didn't want to do another Joker unless it was something completely different. It certainly is. I'm sure the money didn't hurt. I mean, you can offer somebody enough money and they'll magically find a way to do these movies. But I really think he wasn't interested in doing just another Joker sequel that would be a more standard superhero slash supervillain movie. He wanted to do something different, and he certainly did have a different movie. Like it or hate it, it's different.
Now I've got a question for you guys. The final scene, he's talking to his therapist, and then he goes out in the hallway, and he walks down the hallway, and there are red footprints behind him. Did you guys notice that?
Yeah.
So when I was with my buddy, when he goes to his movie, when we left, he's like, why are there red footprints? I don't get it. Now, do you guys understand what the red footprints are all about?
If I remember right, I watched the movie again, but I didn't watch the tail end. But I do remember that part, just not very vividly. But to my understanding, I was under the impression that it was him, his feet prints, and that he was making a mess inside of that asylum, and that it was him like running around and showing that he was acting up in the asylum, like attacking people. And he's like running away and then goes back down the hallway and gets chased by a cop. It's during that same sequence, right?
Yeah, well, it's not a cop; it's an orderly.
Yeah. That was the impression I got, but I'm sure I'm probably off. What was it?
So he starts in the foreground, and he starts walking away from the camera and leaving the footprints behind him. What you're talking about is when he's walking from the running from the left side to the right side and back forth again as an orderly chases him, kind of like out of a Scooby-Doo movie.
Yeah.
But the red footprints, they're supposed to be implying the fact that he just killed his therapist.
Yeah, I thought that was a given.
Were there any other scenes that stuck out to you guys?
Yeah, actually, everything for where he decides I'm going to do stand-up comedy. I really like, because you know, he's at the comedy show, and then he's up there trying to tell jokes, and you see flashes of his notebook where he's looking out for jokes or whatever. But when it actually shows you the notebook, pretty much any time in the movie, it's not like it's these really written out detailed jokes. It's like stuff scrawled everywhere. There's photos where people's faces are scratched out. There's, you know, it looks like some of it looks like it might be pornography with things drawn all over it or whatever. And then there's like, you know, poorly written and poorly spelled little blurbs that are what he's using to tell his jokes. And they're not even really jokes. They're kind of Seinfeld-y insights, but really dark ones. Like one of his jokes up there is talking about how his mom never thought he'd ever never do any hard work. He's like, I don't have to because I'm a comedian. And like, he thinks it's going over super well, but then you see later on, it really didn't. It's just even with this, even when you see him do a stand-up, he's not funny to anybody. He hasn't been funny to anybody the whole movie. He doesn't seem to understand what really makes a joke or makes people laugh. He's just got this really dark outlook on life that he finds funny. But again, is it that he finds it funny, or is it that he has this condition where he laughs at very uncomfortable and unfortunate things?
Here's a scene. He's watching a comedian and he's taking notes. Later on, you get to see those notes. You're right. He doesn't understand what funny is. And he's actually writing out what people laughed at and what they thought was funny. So he'll craft jokes around that. It's kind of like almost like an alien observing human nature and saying, well, they seem to think this is interesting. So that's what I've got to speak a similar way.
Well, and that whole scene where he's taking the notes, if you watch, he only laughs at times where no one else is laughing. He laughs at not inappropriate times, just times that are not where the joke's hitting. He's just laughing because it's silent. He's uncomfortable. So he just laughs loudly and then starts taking notes. And also, anytime he takes notes, did you notice that he can't spell? He writes very poorly. He can't spell. It's intentional to kind of also highlight that he's had this upbringing that did not give him the right education. It did not give him any of the things you need to be a healthy individual that's going to operate in society.
For me, I guess, just the iconic ending when he's on the cop car and there's chaos around him. And when he finally puts the blood to his lips and he makes the smile and it's all kind of come full circle. That's the moment you're kind of waiting on from the beginning, I guess, or I was at least. And when you finally get to see it, you're like, all right, I want a number two. And then we get number two and it's like, I rented it to do this show and I've been wanting to see it. I thought the Lady Gaga deal would be interesting. Harley Quinn's just as iconic as the Joker is, obviously, and Margot Robbie did a great job, I thought. But this one, again, the Folie à Deux, I think it's just one of those movies that just needed to be a part one and done, and the money talks. And I just don't really understand the direction they went. I was able to tolerate. There's a lot of like they when I first heard it was coming out, and people were on the internet criticizing it, saying it was a musical, and I was like, "There's no way in hell." But sure enough, it's like more or less a musical. It was a little fun and campy early on in the movie, but after about halfway through, I was just like fast forwarding through the music stuff. I had no desire to watch that. And I was trying to see where it was going to go with Arthur, when he was going to do cool Joker stuff. Like, but it was more, to my opinion, that movie was more focused about Harley and I guess their relationship. But I wanted it to pick up where it left off in number one with Arthur and with him coming full circle now and really embracing this Joker persona that he had. And it just never really got to it. But then again, I didn't watch the last 30 or 40 minutes, so I probably missed quite a bit. So,
do you know what happens at the end of it? I mean, I don't want to spoil it. I guess we don't want to say too much because maybe we'll do an episode on the Joker 2 at some point in the future. You know, it is a sequel. If you want to watch the Joker become the crime lord Joker that you see in other DC Batman era Joker stuff, then perhaps you will not appreciate the sequel. The sequel is more of a continuation of the story of Arthur Fleck and his descent into madness and then his kind of returning from madness, but then kind of going back into it. I don't know. I can see why people did not like this movie. I did not hate the sequel as much as I thought I would, but I also went into it expecting that I would hate it, and I in fact did not. I'm going to save any other commentary because I would think at some point doing a sequel episode on Joker 2 would be worth it.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, I'll watch the last 30 minutes of it while I've got it on demand for the next 24 hours, and next time I come back, we'll weigh in on that.
Yeah, so listeners, 1 year from now, Joker Part 2. No, but now, I do have to ask this question just because we mentioned this in a previous episode. Jeremy, would Fergal qualify this as a accidental musical or a on-purpose musical?
No, it's an on-purpose musical. Much as the way in this movie you're not quite sure what's real and what's not, I think the musical sections of Joker 2 are more parts that may not be real. And I think it's done well for what they're trying to do. But again, I went into it knowing that there were a lot of musical numbers and expecting it to be awful. And I didn't hate it, but I can see the why people might not. And I'm not defending it to say like you just don't understand it. No, I think it's depending what you're looking for out of the movie will determine how you feel about it once it's over.
Yeah, this is very different.
Now this is an origin movie, Jeremy. We know how you feel about origin movies, but does it pull it off?
I know I say a lot that I don't like origin stories. Here's my clarification, and I know that no one's gonna go back and care, but I don't like that every time you have like a movie about a character that you have to do their origin every time. I do disagree with that generally. And I think the later, even though they're not very good, the later Batman movies and the earlier, the 80s, 90s Batman do that pretty well where they're like, you know what? After Batman 1, we're not going to talk about the origin of Batman. There might be flashbacks to something that connects him to an event or something that happened in the past, but you don't need to go through the how did Batman become Batman, right? You have that in the first one and it moves on. Even though they had different people playing Batman, fine. I don't mind in this case because, one, you have the unreliable narrator piece, so you're not really sure if this truly is even his actual origin story or if he's making up 90% of this or if it's all true. You don't know. Also, it's trying to explain how somebody that may not, you know, how would somebody become that crazy to where they become a criminal mastermind in a realistic world, right? This is a more realistic take on the world. It's not, you know, it's not like, oh yeah, he fell into chemicals and he became a bad guy, or he was hit with moon, you know, with galactic rays and now he has like super strength. Like instead, it's very much like how does a person lose their mind enough to where they can go and become this kind of criminal, like this chaotic being that just wants to sow chaos everywhere. And I think they actually did a very good job in this of explaining that and the chaos parts, right? I mean, he doesn't intend to start off this worldwide, this citywide riot, but he does. And once he realizes he does, at first, he's kind of like, oh, that's terrible. But at the same time, he's kind of happy with himself. He's very impressed with what he's been able to pull off because the city has done nothing but hurt him. So why not hurt everything else, too?
I'm glad you said it's authentic. There's a I was reading an article in Vanity Fair saying Adrian Raine was looking at this movie, saying he's a neurocriminologist. And he saw this movie and actually saw how authentic it was, showing someone mentally breaking down and be turning into a criminal. He actually uses this movie in his his classes that he teaches at the University of Pennsylvania.
I just want to say the other thing they do really to kind of focus on the mental illness part is, you know, he has this caseworker he works with in the city. They pull all the funding from this caseworking program. And they even say, like, well, he's like, how am I supposed to get my medicine? And she's like, I don't know. They don't care about you. They don't care about me. They don't care about any of this. So it's a further falling apart, right? It's not just that he's had this terrible life and then he had some kind of a way to stay even keeled enough to at least survive to help his mom and everything else with this medication. All of a sudden, his medication's gone too. You don't know what it was stopping, except that towards the end, that's when he starts having these much heavier hallucinations. He obviously loses control of what makes sense or not to make sense as far as a violence standpoint goes. So like, I also like the part that they didn't just say, oh yeah, he just slowly goes crazy because life gets harder. It's like, no, he was already on a regimen of medicines and they just cut them. And as somebody who's dealing with that in some way, not myself, but in general in my life, you can't just cut that medicine off. People do insane things. So it makes complete sense to me.
I know people personally that have been through that sort of thing. And, medicine it's a very important part, you know what I mean? And sometimes people want to say, well, this is just designed to keep somebody dumbed down or this and that. But a lot of the times it does help and it helps everybody differently. And, so I thought again, from the position of an origin piece, I thought this was really well done because you get to see all these little bitty, just one step further each time, you know what I mean? And it's got this slow build up and you're like, man, how much more can he take? And then finally, those chumps in the subway are giving him crap. And, you know, and that's when it happens. And, but you can see, not to justify it or to rationalize it, but you can understand why somebody might want to act out that way or what would lead to that happening. And then because of the way it all unfolded and then how it ended, even with him going into the loony bin, leaving that open ended, I just thought it was a really cool movie. Again, though, it's not easy. It's not the easiest movie to watch. So be forewarned if you do want to check it out and you haven't seen it yet, if you're listening to this. But again, I would recommend it.
The Joker always says, he even says in this movie at 1.2, it's just one bad day is a sort of tips you over the edge. But it's really, I think it's a series of bad days back to back that just breaks a person in this case.
What's his whole life? His whole life has been this, right? I mean, he says it even like, you know, I thought my life was a tragedy, but it's a comedy or whatever. Like his whole life has been, as you find out through these, you know, the medical records from his mom and everything else that you see, like he's pretty much been in some way tortured and or left alone inappropriately his entire life.
And he tries, you know what I mean? It shows him like he's actually trying. As mundane and boring and simple as his life may be to most people or whoever, for him, he was in a good place at the beginning of the movie until right when it starts and he gets beat on by those kids and taken advantage of, made fun of for being a clown. And that's just the first example of seeing like how difficult this guy's life is. But he's always like that song, you know, the Put On a Happy Face song that I believe that they do play. I forget what famous singer sings it, but he's always kind of like, he's an upbeat guy for the most part, you know, and then just one thing leads to another and just like, I'm done being that guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he's barely hanging on. I mean, he's kind of got his stuff together at the start of the movie. He's got a job. He's got a place to live. And all of a sudden it starts falling apart. He loses this job and he starts this other thing. He thinks he's going to be good at doing stand up, and instead he's publicly ridiculed by somebody that he thought was kind of this beloved father figure, despite that that's not real. He thought he had a relationship with a neighbor, also completely delusional. His mother gets sick. She's kind of been one of the things that's keeping him going, is making sure he can take care of her. She gets sicker and sicker to the point where she's going to die. Now, ultimately, he's the one that kills her. But still, up to this point, you know, when she's in the hospital, all these other things are happening. He's been barely hanging on there. And all of a sudden, everything that's kind of keeping him grounded to the earth all falls apart one at a time, leading him to where he is. And part of that also is, if you notice, that's when let me get rid of that. Also, you know, it's right after they changed his regimen for his medicine, so that could have been part of it. This could all be a medically caused delusion. And then, you know, later on, he loses the medicine. And that's, you know, that's what I liked about this. I think it's a really good look at how somebody could go down this path, even though it's, you know, completely unrealistic for the events that happened. But just having somebody's life fall apart because of a change in medication, because of a lack of support, is what I think really makes it stand out. And what I think, again, if you saw this movie and they put it out where it wasn't the Joker, if it was just Clown Guy or whatever, sure, it would be hard to not make the comparison because of the makeup. But I think people's complaints about how this movie doesn't tie to DC or complaints even on the sequel more would be less loud because you wouldn't have this tie into the DC universe.
Now, this movie is just over 122 minutes long. Was it paced well?
I think it was. I think it was paced very well. It's, what is that, just over 2 hours? The sequel is a little longer than that, I believe. When I went into that movie, I was kind of like, eh, I hope it's as good as the first one. Because the first one I did enjoy, and there weren't any really slow moments that dragged on to me. There were some parts that were drug out, but they were just kind of like, they were hard to watch. But you're just like, man, like the moments where he's like on the couch and he's stretching and like you see his body and just how skinny and emaciated he is. And it's just like, oh, let's get through this and get on to the next part. But I thought it was really well done, and I thought that it paced really well. Once it gets going with the scenes of violence and the dissension starts to kind of, you know, come to a head and everything, it moves a lot quicker, I think. Before you know it, it's over. Just takes a little while to get there, but in a good way.
Actually, yeah, I think this is paced really well. I had watched this today. I had watched it all in one sitting. I thought that for the running time of just 2 hours for the standard, I'm sure your steelbook has like 30 minutes of additional footage, but the standard, you know, just over 2 hours, they cover a lot of ground. It was something I would expect to go longer, perhaps be broken up into two movies for the kind of descent of Arthur. But I really thought this was paced well. Now, again, I did watch the sequel right after this, and I can't say the same thing for the sequel. I had to stop that several times, take a break and come back to it. But I don't know if that's also because I watched them back to back in a 4.5-5 hour block. But this first movie on its own, I had no problems with the pacing.
Yeah, the original cut was 155 minutes, but they had to trim it down to get it that rated R rating. And also, the original cut of it was just dragged a little bit too long. So I did have a question for you guys. Is this is one of many recent movies that follows the origin of a villain versus that of a hero. How do you feel about villains as main characters?
I think it's a lot of the time they're done to be funnier, right? Like we watch Suicide Squad. That's all villains that have to go tongue in cheek. It's fun. I think Venom also tries to do a lot of jokes. This ironically does not try to do a lot of jokes very seriously, but also, again, it's going to be really hard to find a villain that's bigger than Joker as far as like a name. You could looking at Marvel, I guess you could go with someone like Dr. Octopus or whatever, but that's still not as big as Joker. Like Joker is the villain. And he's also, because of the fact that he's had so many different, origins, whether or not they're true or not, there's also been that he was an existing thing. It's not like you didn't see him in the comics. Like Batman wasn't already a major thing. And then Joker shows up later, like a lot of other villains. He was the first villain in the first Batman. I mean, I know that Batman was around a little beforehand, slightly beforehand for Detective Comics, but like, if you're going to start a run of a superhero, then to have that same supervillain go with him the entire time. I mean, Joker's pretty much the number one, I guess. Next, what, Lex Luthor? But there's enough on Lex Luthor, and he's basically just a rich guy, right? So like, you don't need to do a big background for Lex. Yeah, and I was going to say, and they're doing whole movies essentially explaining Doctor Doom. So that's a sport.
How'd you guys feel about the CGI in this movie?
I thought it was good. I didn't really see a whole lot of it, so that's usually a good sign whenever you don't see it. Although, I mean, the blood probably was, obviously, but we've seen so much of that now, and they've gotten so good at these types of scenes that depict violence, where they can, like, walk up, like, straight in the guy's face and, like, shoot, and it's like, damn, if I was an actor, I wouldn't want anybody doing that, even with blanks and stuff, because, you know, things can happen. And I personally didn't really see a whole lot, so I guess that's a good thing, personally.
I'd say the same thing. There's no point where I was like, that looks like garbage. I thought it looked very good.
Because you can't see it when it's not any good sometimes, you know?
Oh, yeah. 100%.
I'm glad you guys said that, because most of the CGI is actually really done for the backgrounds. Because what they do is they did the New York landscape, and then they would change it so it couldn't be one-for-one lined up with New York. So, like, the graffiti on the walls, all CGI.
Okay, cool. Yeah, they look great.
Extending the streets, awesome. All CGI. So, just think of anything in the background, most that's going to be CGI. And it wasn't because it was on a green screen. They literally filmed where they were going to film, and then change areas around it, sort of touching it up. So where your focus is not going to be, but that way it's a fuller city and nice. It feels bigger than what it is, but it's like not, may they make it into Gotham, but they turn New York into Gotham. They can change architecture, things like that.
I figured some of the riot stuff too was probably, there's probably CG stuff thrown in there because there's so much going on and you're not going to want to redo that 1,000 times, but
the one thing I do want to bring up, just because yes, Jeremy, I had the steelbook and I watched some of the behind the scenes stuff. There's a garbage strike going on for this movie. Did you know the garbage is different based on what part of the city you're in? Because, you know, the garbage is building up in different areas. So what they looked is like sort of like the working man's garbage looks one way. The aristocrat garbage looks this way. It's like some garbage is cleaner than other people's garbage. And I just love that kind of detail on a movie. Like they just put bags of garbage around. They said, okay, what would it look like in a working neighborhood versus the hospital versus, you know, the subway station? So the garbage is actually different based on where the scene is occurring.
That's a nice touch.
And to make this movie work too, there's a little glimpse of it in the subway scene, but they actually went out and made several maps of Gotham for the subway lines. And they were actually trying to figure out like if he's going from his house to, or his apartment to the hospital, does he have to take a train? Does he have to take the car? They try to make sure you work with the maps they created. So that way, as I said, the city feels more alive. And we do see a lot of Fleck in a, you know, in mass transit. He's sitting on a bus. He's, you know, in the train. And I just like love that kind of detail when it comes to movies like this. They didn't have to do that. There's a lot of movies that just cut away to the next scene.
Right.
So we have this Joker origin story. Do you guys want another villain background story like this? And if so, whose?
Without having to get into too much into it, but the Robert Pattinson, Christopher Reeve Batman movie, I really enjoyed. It did kind of drag a little bit from time to time, but I thought it was really well. And they are supposed to be getting into Mr. Freeze, I've heard rumors about. I think that's the one that I would like to see because, again, the Arnold Schwarzenegger one was, at the time when I was a teenager, it was great. You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger was everywhere and it was just so crazy. It's just to see Batman on the screen was awesome, but I would really like to see them delve into that character. He's pretty cool.
I'm going to have to just, I mean, simply say no, unfortunately. Like I'm sure I'd see them, but I don't need full movies about the background of a villain because they always do a good job. Like we just mentioned Dr. Doom. They're going to have him, I mean, his origin ties to the Fantastic Four anyway, but then they're going to have all these other things where he ties into eventually go into the, you know, Avengers 4 Doomsday or whatever they're going to call it. Right. So they're going to have all these different things that tie in. So you're going to get his backstory. And I think I felt the same.
I was thinking like an origin inside of another movie. I misunderstood what you said. As far as like a whole standalone movie, I could probably do without Victor Freeze's story. But if he wanted to like just like brief origins and stuff, or the origin taking over like half the movie or something, that'd be pretty cool to see him. But yeah, I like Jeremy said, I don't know that there's anyone in particular. Marvel, the MCU does a really good job of working their characters in and then not really needing a lot of context or origin. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with Dr. Doom. Again, though, I don't need a whole Dr. Doom movie.
Yeah, or like what the MCU did with Thanos, right? There's little seeds in all these movies of, you know, who Thanos is and where he comes from, why he's such a dangerous threat. And that therefore, when he shows up in the Avengers Endgame and stuff, you're like, oh, yeah, of course this guy's like a supervillain. They're going to have to all get together to stop him without having to have a whole movie about, here's Thanos. Here's Thanos as a kid. Here's Thanos doing whatever. I think that's another good win.
The Born Again TV series, if y'all haven't seen that yet, Daredevil, a character they did really well on that one with, because I didn't see the Netflix series, but I was familiar with the different tie-in movies and John Bernthal playing Punisher, saw a few of those, really liked it, but didn't really watch any of the Netflix Daredevil. Knew Vincent D'Onofrio was a kingpin, so I was going into this real fresh, and I really have enjoyed the Daredevil series so far. But they did Bullseye really well early on, I thought. You get right into that with them. And he doesn't have a lot of background yet. You know, I don't know if we're going to get there or what, but they did a really good job of bringing in a character that's vital to the Daredevil story and just kind of throwing him in there for him to play with, you know. And I thought they did great.
So this movie, when they started writing the script for it, they were kind of locked into who they were going to have play the various roles. So there's not a lot of who could have been. There's only really a couple, and they didn't want to get your take on this. So the original casting for the Joker was going to be Leonardo DiCaprio.
I could see that, but not as good as I think Joaquin Phoenix is a better method actor, in my opinion, or that kind of actor that can really command the screen more than Cap can, or he's just not quite that. I don't know. I think that Joaquin Phoenix pulls off the crazy guy a little better. You know what I mean?
Well, especially the scenes where you see him all bony, all bruised up. And the fact that he does look a little off. He has that cleft palate. Mm-hmm. Does it make him look a little unique? It really does make him stand out more. You'd have to add makeup or something to Leonardo DiCaprio to make him meet that same thing. So I don't think he would do as well. I was going to say the only other person I think that would do a good job, kind of that extreme method acting, is if you saw Christian Bale, like The Machinist, like he can do the same thing, but he's already sense to make him Joker too. It's like,
hey, why not? You know, Henry Cavill's about to play like four or five characters, if I'm not mistaken. He's all over the place, man.
The only other real casting was Thomas Wayne. You're looking at Alec Baldwin.
That's a weird one. I'm watching Mobland right now. It's fantastic. And Pierce Brosnan, I was kind of on the fence about, and he's just knocked it out of the park. So I'm not going – I'm going to reserve judgment for that one. But I could see it. But I think who they used was that guy relatively unknown? And then the guy that played Alfred was the guy that plays he's famous, man. I'm sorry. I was thinking of the guy from The Boys that plays the main guy that's also Judge Dredd. Anyways, yeah, Alec Baldwin would have been all right, but I thought that guy did a really good job as Thomas Wayne.
Sorry, Thomas Wayne also played the father of he played Barton Blaze, the father of Ghost Rider.
Oh, okay.
Well, that was a long time ago.
It's a long time ago. He also was a congressman in The Dark Knight Rises. The guy's been all over comic book movies.
Everywhere.
Yeah. The other thing was there was a different ending in the original movie, in the original script for it. And I want to get your take on this. So the original script was he escapes during the riot. He eludes him for days, and then he finally they start showing the Wayne's funeral, and Arthur shows up to that, and that's where he's captured.
Yeah, I mean, what I really like is that it is the realistic-ish portrayal of, you know, watching Arthur slowly fall apart as all these things that he's barely held together in his life fall apart that cause him to take these swings, whether it's just losing his job and his dream, his mother getting sicker and giving him no real reason to stay focused, his change in medicine, all of that. I really like that. I like watching, you know, kind of giving you a reason why somebody might take this turn. And I think it's portrayed really well. He's not showing mental illness in a way that's supposed to be funny. Instead, it's kind of very tragic. And I thought that was done very well. And I did like that. What I didn't necessarily like, and I know there's not a lot of it, we've kind of talked about it, but I don't think you needed to have any of the ties to the extended DC universe. I think you could still have called this movie Joker and just had him be somebody who, you know, there's a couple extra scenes where you see him reading comics, some Batman comics where he sees the Joker and therefore he decides to put the makeup on and do whatever. Like, that would have been fine with me. And I think that would have still kept the connection that you need this loose connection to the DC series without saying, oh yeah, this guy is the Joker. I think that the assumption by the public that, oh yeah, this is the Joker, he's going to lead into the same, you know, same character of Joker you'd see in the other Batman movies or the TV shows or the comics, instead of having this completely separate storyline that I think was done very well, but instead you're expecting this tie to Batman that's not in this movie, and I think it hurts the sequel even more than this.
Yeah, that feels like it's just not necessary. The only other way out I see that might have been, I don't know, me personally, would have been if he got away and then it's left open to decide, like, well, where does he go? Where do we go from here? You know, is he going to get caught? Is he going to now form a criminal empire? What's going to happen? But to see it come back to the same ending feels a lot like being railroaded. You know what I mean? So if he's just going to get caught anyways, then who cares about the funeral and all that, you know?
Like, kind of trying to wedge the Waynes into there.
Yeah, just kind of squeeze them in there for fan service or something.
For this movie, guys, what did you love about it? What do you think they could have done a little bit better?
So, like I said, I think the realistic portrayal of, within reason, of why someone would go down this path and the steps it would take to cause someone to completely fall over the edge and become this. I really liked it, right? I thought it was done very well. I liked that it didn't get too into, like, the fact that there are only eight deaths in the movie, right, that we can really talk about specifically, I think is good. There weren't scenes where he just, like, loses his mind on the subway and kills, like, 20 people, or there's not things where he sets up what you'd expect more from, like, the comic book Joker, right? Like, maybe there's a train crash that he causes and 100 people die, or something like that, right? Or he doesn't get into any of these, like, super villain things. It's just really him and his inability to deal with the world up until the end, right? And I also love the talk show theme, the King of Comedy, kind of, you know, following that plot with using the same actor that was Rupert Pupkin, I thought was also very well done. So I was very happy with that. The only thing I'd say is, again, depending on, I would have preferred them completely avoid working it into the rest of DC. It doesn't have to be in Gotham. It could be anywhere else. You don't have to have the Waynes. It's fine that it's there, but I didn't need it there. And I think ultimately, if you were going to do more with this character, which they tried to do again 5 years later, even though that wasn't part of the plan, was detriment. It was a detriment that it had this DC tie. They didn't need it. I mean, you could even call it Joker and have it be a guy that read the Joker comics and then went down this path, right? That would have still had that connection without really saying he is the Joker. And I think that's what hurts the next movie.
Yeah, I would agree with all that. And then the part I really enjoyed the most was, again, showing this realistic side of it. And the fact that none of his lashing out, or his, when his descent would come to like a crescendo, and he would act out violently, that there was still like a methodical, calculated aspect to it, where when we see like him leave his little short buddy alone, like that was the only guy that like ever cut for him in the whole movie, with exception to his social worker, if I'm not mistaken. And as a result of that, he let him live. You know what I mean? He could have just as easily made a bloody mess out of him, but he's like, you know what? You were good to me. I'm gonna leave you alone. You know, and so it just goes to show that he wasn't just completely batshit crazy. You know, no pun intended. But I thought that was a really neat part about how just how real it felt. You know what I mean? It was so like it felt so real that it was just hard to watch sometimes. You're like, don't want to see this guy suffering that much, you know? And so even though there were times when it's like, please, let's get on with this. At the same time, you're like, can't look away, you know? So I thought that was great. And then like Jeremy said, the DC continuity and stuff, could have done without it, but it wasn't a big deal. If anything, it was cool. But again, if they had plans to do a sequel, whenever that was going to be, and you knew they were going to after how successful it was, they could have done more with that character if they would have clipped some of that or you know, known about that ahead of time, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah, for me, what I love about it's also what I struggle with for this movie. It's a great character piece, and it's well written, well acted. Joaquin Phoenix did an amazing job with this, and I enjoy watching it, but I also feel bad about enjoy watching this guy fall into madness.
Right.
I've only seen this movie twice. I probably won't see it again until next year. Mm-hmm. Like it's going to be some time before I go back and visit it again. And it's not because it's hyper violent. There's some violence, but it's more about sort of like you're watching a guy just disintegrate, essentially.
Right.
Like his ego is just melting down. Arthur Fleck becomes nothing. And I really enjoyed the back half of this movie because it really sort of is the Joker. But it's that first part of him getting to that point that it's painful to watch. Not painful because of bad writing or bad movie making. It's painful because he did such a good job with it.
Mm-hmm.
So the one thing I don't say they could do better is just I can't see myself like, I want to go pop this in this afternoon. Like I got to be in the right mind space to watch this thing.
It's not you. It's not one you throw on at the party on Friday night or something. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, guys, let's have some fun tonight. Watch. What do you want to watch? Endgame or Joker?
Yeah.
There actually was a lot of, I don't know if you guys remember this, but when this movie came out, there was a lot in the media about sort of what they thought this would inspire. Mm-hmm. What do you guys remember around that time period?
I remember The Dark Knight being a big deal, and then that kid went into the movie theater. I do remember that, and I think there was some reports in the news about some things happening. I don't know if anything actually came to fruition, but I do remember that them having a lot of controversy surrounding that. I think at the same time, or near that time, was the Punisher logo thing going on too. Or that could have been a little later, but it's like all a blur, man. But the I do remember there being something. I don't remember how that transpired, though.
It was a concern because of what happened with the Dark Knight situation. But also, again, that this came out in 2019. It's in the middle of the first Trump term. You've got everybody doing these race riots. You've got a lot of stuff going on in the country, and to have something that's going on that's essentially saying like, hey, this guy is very upset with society and he's gonna kind of take over this turn, and all the things you saw were like the riots and all the people dressed up like clowns, all the stuff going on, people were very concerned that there would be copycat murders.
Oh yeah, the clown stuff, I forgot all about that, people walking around dressed up like clowns and doing weird stuff.
Yeah, so this was, there was a fear that this would cause, even if it was a handful of people, but that would cause people to yeah, react in the same way he would, because again, he's not doing cartoonish like crimes in this. He's striking out at essentially not random people, but people who don't necessarily deserve to be killed, and he's doing it because it's what he thinks makes sense. So there was no water gun
flowers on his tuxedo or anything like that.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, basically the movie Gotham is like a tin, it was a powder keg ready to explode, and he just happens to be the spark that gets the go in that direction. Yeah, I remember at the time they were really talking about sort of would he inspire things, because the movie really talks about sort of basically the average person is struggling while the rich are doing very well, and you know, you get a spark and this whole riots explode. And yeah, there was a lot of questions around that time period, like would it inspire violence?
I thought it did a good job at addressing mental illness, and it's something that we continue as a nation in a world to struggle with, I think, a lot. And you see it on the internet all the time, and these just this new generation of people, and they record stuff and all these different strange conditions, like the gang stalking and just varying degrees of illness that a lot of the time goes widely unchecked, and before you know it, it's too late, and somebody's flown off the handle and done something. And again, with this movie, you can kind of see why. You know, I mean, or it's a glimpse, it's a window into that type of individual. I felt like maybe that brought up awareness for that a little more, rather than incite violence. I thought maybe hopefully people would kind of watch this movie and draw something good from it rather than take away something bad from it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think the good messaging around that was basically don't cut social service programs.
Yeah.
people need support. You may not know them, but they can affect your life if they don't have it.
Yep.
Now, one thing we didn't mention, I wish we had mentioned, but I love the fact about this movie feels like it takes place in like 1981.
When I was born.
Yeah, I just love the feel of it, the look of it, the grittiness of it. It really felt like New York during that time period. I like movies that don't take place during now because the cell phone solves way too many problems.
Yeah, that's a good point. As a writer and stuff with my comic books and stuff, I've tried my best to get out of the present day because technology is such a difficult thing to get around as far as like murder mysteries and crimes and different things. Cause you know, like you just can't really get away with, you still can, but you can't really get away with a whole lot. Or it just leaves a lot of questions to answer as a writer, like holes to fill for like how somebody could do this or how somebody could do that in this modern digital age we live in, you know?
So I know there was a sequel made for this movie. I know you two guys have seen some of it or all of it, but when you saw this movie the first time, were you thinking about a sequel and what did you want them to explore in that sequel?
Yes and no. Like, I was totally okay with it being a standalone movie. But when it did end, I was kind of like, okay, cool. Now we've gotten through all that and the hard part's over. And now let's just see him just go wreak havoc on Gotham. Regardless of the fact that he was in the mental asylum. So I was open to the idea of it, but at the same time, I would have been totally fine if they just never did anything with it. You know, reboots tend to be a recurring problem nowadays with movies for a lot of people and sequels and stuff. They just never really carried the full, like the pizzazz of the first movie, never quite live up to the predecessor. And so I was with this movie, I was kind of like, yeah, I don't know if it's necessary. And again, I didn't really care much for the second one, but I didn't give it a fair chance by not watching it all the way through. So I will. And in a year from now, maybe I'll have some better news for you guys.
Yeah, I was fine with this being a one and done. I thought this was supposed to, and it was. It was intended to be a one-off kind of side shoot, alternate Joker existence. I liked how it ends because it does have that. You know, he's clearly not out free doing something, but he's also not dead. So you have him there talking to, you know, somebody you assume in Arkham, just kind of trying to piece together what his actual story is. But then in the background, you have that whole, is any of this real? Is any of this not real? So I liked it as a single standalone. I didn't need to see any more of this character. Like I said, I did see the movie, the sequel today. I had up to today avoided it. And again, if we talk about it again in the future, I'll have some more thoughts on it. I will say I did not need a sequel, but I don't hate the one that eventually showed up.
Yeah, for me, I thought it was a one and done. It felt like Elseworld in DC.
Yeah.
And I was happy with that. It felt like that because you see movies like Venom where they go, he's on their third movie at this point.
And yeah.
I feel like it's sort of like going to the same well too many times. And it's like if you can pull off a villain origin story movie, you know, don't roll those dice again. You did a great job. Move on. Yeah. Be satisfied.
I do think that Venom's kind of a weird exception because he has, even in the comics, kind of become a hero, right? So, yeah, he's that anti-hero that was originally just a villain, right? Carnage took his place as the villain version of
Venom. Yeah. I watched that the other night, actually, I haven't seen it in a while. And it was fun seeing Carnage. As much as, you know, there's that movie's criticized, like, seeing Carnage on screen was just so cool. I really enjoyed that. Finally, you know.
So, should people go out and find this film? If they've never seen Joker, should they go see this movie?
Yeah, I'd say for if you like great acting, if you're if you know who Joaquin Phoenix is and you want to see him really shine on the camera, which I do believe he got an Academy Award for this movie, if I'm not mistaken. And if you want to, and Todd Phillips really does well. He's coming off of The Hangover, I think, was his movie, the first movie he did, and that was another one that kind of suffered for sequels. That was great, number one, you know, just took the world by storm. But yeah, if you want to see a very realistic take on somebody that's struggling in their life and what can happen to them when society turns their back on them, I would highly recommend it.
Yeah, this is a good movie. If you don't like superhero movies, if you don't like comic book related movies, this is still a good movie. If you do, it also, I think, still scratches that itch as well. If you are a fan, you may enjoy this still, even though it's not quite what you might expect. No, I think this is very good. This is one of the better movies we've covered as a movie, right? As a piece of film, this is one of the better ones we've done.
Yeah, Jeremy, I think you hit it. It's a good movie. It's not going to be like, I'm going to invite a bunch of friends over and watch it. It's not that kind of movie. It's kind of like you put it on, you absorb it, you let it roll over you. But this is not like, I wouldn't recommend watching this with the kids. You might lose your kids after having watched this movie, but it is a good movie. It's a good film. But like I was saying earlier, I don't think I'm going to watch it again for a few more months. If I am, like it's high quality, but it will disturb you a little bit as you're watching it.
I finished watching it today and I had to go outside and leave my house for a bit. Like I took the dogs for a walk. I just had to re-normalize myself because it really does suck. And like, if you watch this at night, and then go out and do something, it's going to be a little different than if you have a chance to recalibrate, go outside in the day, see the world, and then go out the rest of your day.
So this is a movie you should watch at 11 o'clock, grab some lunch, and then go outside for a walk. Make sure the weather's good so it's not raining.
The first time I saw this, I came home at night. I only saw the last half. I was already a little bit inebriated or whatever. So I left seeing the first one. I was like, that's the darkest, craziest thing I've ever seen. And I didn't hate it, but I was like, that was nuts. And then when I saw it again today, I was like, no. It's more of a movie. It's much more than what I expected from watching the last act.
I do remember when Buddy and I came back from watching this at the theaters, it was a very quiet car ride.
It's like, what did we just watch?
So overall, what would your rating be for this movie? How many thumbs up do you give it?
Since I only have two thumbs to give, I would give it two thumbs up.
Yeah, it's a solid thumb up for me. It's a definite watch. Again, very good star on it, though, is it's not for children at all. Do not watch this one with kids. You know, any of the other Batmans we've watched, sure, feel free. Go ahead and have your kids watch it. Maybe if they're super young, maybe not. But otherwise, like my kids now are, 11, 13. They can watch any of these movies we watch. This is probably the first one. And I'm like, yeah, no, they're not going to watch this one.
Yeah, this is definitely one of the few movies that we're all giving a thumbs up to, without a doubt. Well, guys, thanks for joining me tonight for this. But in close, so Joffrey, where can people find you and what are you currently working on?
You can find me as far as my personal creations go. You can go to kingdomcomics.com. It's KEYNGDOM comics.com, spelled a little differently. You can see everything I'm working on there. I'm in the process of doing some reprinting for some of my previous works. I do a lot of horror, very much into the violent, crazy, weird, unsettling stuff. But I also now have a mafia story out called Cosa Nostra's Comrade, it's set in the 80s, which was a lot of fun. We got to play in that world in New York. Now, just like you mentioned about the Joker. And then I got to pretend to be all these different characters because I write and letter my own stuff. And I partnered with my buddy Jacob for this one. It was his idea and I kind of just brought it to life. So that's the most recent book that I've released. But I've got a new sci-fi book called End of Man that's about to come out in the next, month or two. And then I've got couple of short stories in an ash can that were really fun about like monster hunters. That I did for a coin, like a digital coin for these guys. They had like a video game world, and it's hard to explain, but they were trying to do a lot of different multimedia stuff, and they brought me and my buddy in to help them with this sort of anthology type thing. So I'm going back and relettering that, and I'm release that for free because that's their property. And I do want people to see that. It's a lot of fun, Dracula and werewolves and stuff. And then my big one will be in a couple more months. I'm going to get back to Kickstarter and launched my horror book called Roseville. I'll have the second one going and I'll offer number one and number two, and I'm going to have all sorts of neat stuff. You guys mentioned the Gotham maps earlier on the subway, and I've got a professional, really, really talented guy, friend of mine named Jordan Dorenzo, who's going to be working on a map of Roseville. So it's really neat. It's going to have this old kind of weathered and burned and coffee-stained look to it, and people will get to have an opportunity to get that, and then they can then reference where they're at in the book. They can kind of see the course that the protagonist takes, where he might be going next, or, you know, kind of like those old ones in the old video games when you take out the pamphlet and look in there and you get to see something, you know, that you haven't quite explored yet. You know, like, oh, I wonder what's there. Or I wonder if he's going to go there, you know, and it's a lot of fun. So it's and then also it challenges me to then stay on course and to stay true to that story. And that map is kind of like an anchor piece for that. So it'll be fun to watch how that unfolds. But yeah, man, a lot going on. I'm just trying to stay busy, and thanks for having me, man. It's always a pleasure, and hopefully I can come back soon and do it again.
And all those links will be on the show notes as well as on our website. If you go to movie-smash.com, they're right there under the guest tab. So, and Jeremy, where can people find you?
I don't have nearly as much going on. I'm here every 2 weeks to talk about movies with you on Movie Smash, but also every other week I'm on the Retrovaniacs podcast talking about old video games.
Awesome, man. For me, you can always find me over at Off Panel Creations. We're always building some piece of nerdy furniture over there. I want to thank our listeners for spending some time with us today. If you think that this was the best Joker, maybe you find you have a better Joker you enjoy, send us a note over at movie-smash.com, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. This has been Movie Smash with Chris Roberts, Jeremy Parmentier, and Fergal Amayo, produced by me, Chris Roberts, executive produced by Off Panel Creations, LLC. Movie clips provided by the respective studios. You can rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You might even find your review read on a future episode. Got a question for us? Visit us at movie-smash.com and send us a note. It too can be read on a future episode. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Movie Smash wherever you listen to your podcasts.
All right, I want a number two.